Welcome to another episode of 2024. I am Joseph, he, him. I am joined today by Nigel Johnson, he, him, and Jacqueline Small, she, her. And today we are going to talk about historically black colleges and universities and multicultural spaces. Nigel is a recent graduate of Howard University. He majored in political science and will be attending law school at Howard. Jacqueline is a fourth-year honors student at the University of North Florida. She studies criminal justice and international studies with a concentration in foreign language and culture. She is the founder of For a Black Girl, a nonprofit that establishes a safe space for women of color through empowerment, creativity, and discussion. Nigel and Jacqueline, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
Excited to be here.
All right. So, first to start off, Nigel, would you like to go into some of the historical backgrounds of HBCUs and what they are and are not?
Sure. You know, HBCUs are the product of the fact that, number one, after emancipation, you know, the country had millions of African slaves and the descendants of Africans who had no place to turn to in terms of education and no place to turn to as it came to establishing them as full citizens in the United States of America. And that's where we get these types of laws from Reconstruction, you know, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, 14th Amendment establishing them as citizens, and the 15th Amendment establishing their right to vote. And so what happened is, you saw Northern missionaries from the Northern states coming down into Southern states, establishing schools for a lot of these newly freed enslaved people to be able to actually preach the gospel. A lot of these HBCUs were established as schools for ministers and for preachers. And so we see a lot of, Black church leaders across the South and across the United States who have attended HBCUs. They've grown much larger now and into different fields. Now they're spreading out into, STEM. We're spreading out into the arts. And so in terms of what HBCUs are, HBCUs are first and foremost an environment, right, where African Americans and even Black people from across the world have been able to come and experience not only a world-class education, but also this environment where they're free to be themselves and express themselves how they truly want to. What an HBCU is not is this environment where some people think they're coming to get a second-class education or an environment where they're not getting an education that they could receive at a Harvard or a Yale or at any other predominantly white institution. And that's not the case. HBCU students, compare, very strongly, if not better, with other predominantly white institution graduates. And, you can look at that in every facet of life. We're in the entertainment industry. We're in the legal industry. The first Black Supreme Court justice was a graduate of the Howard University School of Law. You could look at the vice president, Kamala Harris, and you can even look at, advancements across the nation. Brown v. Board of Education, which integrated public schools across the country, was a result of the legal minds produced at an HBCU. So HBCUs, whether people know about them or not, have been making massive contributions to this nation for years.
Dang, that was really good. What I really kind of find interesting when researching a little bit into HBCUs was that they were founded really kind of in this weird time where you didn't really have a lot of the more nuanced ideas on anti-racism and diversity, equity, and inclusion that we really have displayed today. A lot of HBCUs were actually like founded by white people that had like a negative, that still had negative views of African Americans. They still carried a lot of racism, even if they were abolitionists. I just have really found that interesting that they've turned from being spaces that were very much at first controlled by white people to now being spaces where really very nuanced ideas have been formulated. A lot of the Black excellence that we see in society today are products of HBCUs. It's just, it's really interesting to see that historical turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, you know, HBCUs are communities, right? They're not necessarily just brick and mortar, lifeless institutions. And so when something is a community, as you said, they change, they transform. You know, new information becomes available, new presidents of these universities take over, new demographics start to come into the space. And so, yeah, if you look at the demographic, go ahead and look at some of the images of the students who used to attend historically Black colleges and universities. You'll see, you know, Joseph, you'll see students who kind of look like you. You know, that you'll see fair skinned Black kids. Some students might even be white. At the first few students at Howard University were the daughters of the white administrators on the campus. They weren't Black students, you know. And so we've come such a long way, you know, over 150 years, some even longer at some institutions, where we're no longer seeing these, you know, as you say, racist ideas of dominance and just trying to train Black people to think in a conventional way, think the way that, you know, the white society wants them to think. You know, HBCUs are still transforming, right? And we're still trying to figure out how we can produce this pedagogy and how we can produce this environment where we're training scholars not to just think about how society wants us to think, but to think outside of those boxes and to think about how we can transform society.
I want to actually briefly touch on Nigel, your family history with your great-grandfather. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. So in 1926, my great-grandfather, Mordecai Wyatt Johnson, was, you know, unanimously elected to be the first Black president of Howard University. And so that kind of goes back to the point I was previously making. Howard University was opened in 1867, right? And so from the period of from 1867 until 1926, Howard University had 10 presidents who were all white men, who were all white ministers, right? And they weren't necessarily, you know, menaces or, you know, trying to harm the institution in any way, but it's very difficult for, you know, someone who's not necessarily from your background to be able to relate to you, you know, and relate to the issues that you hold dear to you. And so my great grandfather, you know, he's a product of an HBCU. He graduated from Atlanta Baptist College, which is now known as Morehouse College. And his wife, my great grandmother, graduated from Spelman College. And so, you know, being from Tennessee and being the son of formerly enslaved Americans, that's what was available to him at that time. He couldn't, you know, there were certain schools which he couldn't attend. When he wanted to attend theology school and seminary after he graduated, there was a school in New York. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but because of his ancestry, he was denied from being able to, you know, attend that institution. So, you know, I think he had a very unique experience. He was a lighter skinned man. Some people looking at him at first glance might think that he's a white man, but he always, you know, stayed true to himself. And he used that very unique experience being the son of formerly enslaved people to kind of guide his leadership style and guide how he thought HBCUs should present themselves and play a role in American society.
Amazing. Nigel, you touched a little bit on this with Brown v. Board of Education. So I want to kind of jump to talking about that because there are a few aspects of that decision that were actually like incorrect, because like the opinion of Brown v. Board, there were two things that were really motivating Earl Warren when he was writing it. It was one, to be able to have a unanimous decision. So even if there was like a draft of an opinion that was significantly more anti-racist, maybe I don't think he could have really gone for that necessarily, because he was having to convince the entire Supreme Court, some of which it was actually like filled with avid segregationists. And then the other thing was just the pretty much being unaware of him centering his whiteness. There was this one point that Warren made about integration that just completely missed the mark and really set the pace of how integration would go. So with Brown v. Board, it outlawed school segregation, yes, but did it fix any resource disparities necessarily? It did not, because Warren was more focused on integration just as getting black school children into whiter schools. He was mainly concerned with that and not making the schools that black children were already in, not giving them more resources.
Absolutely. And, you know, there were subsequent court cases after that, post-integration, where, you know, litigators sought to kind of change the way public schools were funded, right? Public schools are funded based on the property taxes and the locations where they are. And when you just think about it for a second, the fact that African Americans and Black Americans living in this country historically live in poorer communities, right? If you're living in a community with people who are lower income, right, living in homes that have been subjected to redlining, and so now they have lower values, right? If your home has a lower value, that means you're going to pay less in property taxes. So if your school, you know, funding is tied to property taxes and people aren't able to pay as much as they could in a white community, that means inherently black schools and black neighborhoods are always going to be, you know, having less resources than those in white schools. And just like you said, Joseph, they missed the mark in assuming that just because, you know, black students could go to white schools and on the other side of that coin, white students could also go to black schools, right? That the resources would just start flowing that way, because people would have no choice but to make sure black students are, you know, receiving the same type of education, when we know that's not necessarily the case. And so in those subsequent court cases in which, you know, they tried to change the way that public schools are funded, the Supreme Court came back and said, well, you know what, there's not even a right to education in the Constitution, right? And so, you know, I don't think anyone believes that, you know, that's justification for that type of a decision. You know, there's a right to freedom in the Constitution. There's a right to liberty in the Constitution under the Fifth Amendment. And that's been used before, you know, to expand educational rights in this country. So I think, for one, that definitely needs to be relooked at, the fact that there are disparities in the way schools are funded. But to your point, it's absolutely right. You can't just take students who were in a black school and take students that were in an all white school and put them all in one room and all of a sudden expect all of the issues and the funding resources to go away, because it didn't happen that way.
Right, exactly. And like with the property tax issue, that issue was created by redlining and the legacy of racist policies that the U.S. government enacted.
Absolutely.
There's this one quote by Martin Luther King Jr. that really just gets at the problem of the Brown decision, where he said, quote, this is him talking privately to black teachers in Montgomery, Alabama, I think. He said, quote, white people view black people as inferior. People with such a low view of the black race cannot be given free rein and put in charge of the intellectual care and development of our boys and girls. Real quick, just what are y'all's thoughts on what King said in this?
I was going to say, I completely agree with what he said. And I kind of have the same opinion when it comes to, like, when people will make comments about racism and just, I don't see how you can see, I just was thinking about like back to slavery when Black people weren't even considered a whole person. And so like that way of thinking, just, I don't see how they can have those type of thoughts if they can't even address us as people.
I agree. And I think, you know, it should cause us to pause and think about the way our schools are run now and how they've been historically run. You know, there's been a debate really post-COVID about what the role of parents should be in the educational process, right? Some people have, you know, come to the conclusions that parents should have the final say on what children are being educated on in schools. But we know that what someone is being educated with in a school doesn't just impact the parents of those students, it impacts the entire society, right? So it's about, I guess, striking that balance. And, you know, what we've seen recently, especially in Florida, is a governor and a state legislature who have taken the initiative on their own to decide that all matters of curriculum should be decided at the state level, and that the state knows what's best and that parents know what's best, but teachers and educators and people on the school board and apparently math book manufacturers don't know what's best to teach our students anymore. So, you know, I think Dr. King hit it right on the nail when he's talking about they should not have the ability to take care of the intellectual care and development of our students and our Black people. For those very reasons, I think there's been a legacy in this country of, you know, white parents going and demanding what's going to be taught to their students. And I can't imagine that, you know, they were very excited to have Black students joining their students and learning certain things. So, you know, I think there should definitely be more thought put into that.
I definitely hear what you're saying, Ryland. I agree. And I was just thinking, like, how kind of the their regard for themselves to like have control over what we learn and say that we can't learn about our history, but still continue to forge theirs onto us. And that just doesn't sit right with me. And then the other thing I was gonna say is, this is even bigger than just education. And I think the lack of having, which I'm sure we'll get into later, multicultural spaces, is this kind of thinking as Black people as inferior is evident in the way that our current country as a whole is the state of it.
Right, exactly. Like you have with a lot of the parental rights people that last summer I sparred with in school board meetings. Those were not fun times. I hated that. But anyway, with what they are doing is that they're trying to exert control over the education system, and it's a move that has been done time and time again throughout history, as you said. And like they're saying, like, parents have the right to determine their child's education. I mean, there's really two things. One, first of all, you're only talking about one child. Even if you take that argument in good faith, why should the education of your one child affect the education of the entire school district or the entirety of the education system? And two, it's always going to be selective listening for whichever politicians and everything that control the education system. It's always going to be selective listening and what they want to be able to hear. What they're going to want to hear is about a lot of these Republican education commissioners and governors, they want to hear about opposition to critical race theory. They want to hear about opposition to teaching about what the heck gender is. And they're always going to claim to be on the side of parents because the parents that they listen to represent this kind of minority voice that's very loud. They're always just going to take that and be like, oh, we have these people on our side.
I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, the details come from the silence, right? Because you see, in the 21st century, Jim Crow doesn't operate the same way he did before, right? He doesn't even use the name Jim Crow. He uses the name James Crow, right? He operates in a very silent way, in the sense that when, you know, these white parents are dominating at school board meetings and the white state legislature decides what is permissible and isn't permissible for our students to learn, that's effectively saying that, you know, the white minority in these cases has the right to define what is and isn't permissible for, you know, students to learn without ever having to say that, right? And that's a point that Jacqueline made. And I think, you know, what is going to be key to crushing this is about being explicit, right? We have to explicitly call out, just like what you did, Joseph, and say, you know what, we know what this is, right? Underneath the sheets, underneath the covers, we know this is just an attempt for a certain group of people to keep history written the way they've had it written for hundreds of years, right? History is written by the victors. And what's happening right now is the victors are starting to realize they no longer have the control that they once had. And the story is going to be retold the way that it actually happened, or closer to the way that it actually happened. And that makes them very uncomfortable.
Exactly. I want to shift actually to talking about the curriculum of HBCUs and kind of like the differences between HBCU curriculum and PWI curriculum and what they center. Nigel, could you go into that a little bit?
Sure. We get it all, right? We get it all. And the reason for that is because this is the world that we live in, right? We, you know, there's this this myth, right? And it's not just perpetuated by, you know, white people. It's perpetuated by Black people as well, people who haven't gone to HBCUs, that, you know, at HBCUs, all we learn about is Black curriculum, right? We only learn about Black political theory and Black political theorists. We only learn about Black poetry and Black contributors to science and arts, when in fact, that's just not the case. You know, we learn about the Eurocentric academies. You know, we've learned about Aristotle. We learned Plato. We learned about Jean-Jacques Rousseau. We learn about all of these different political theorists, John Locke. You know, we go into feudalism and European history. We talk about European art and Eurocentric art. The difference is that we get a holistic view, right? We don't just get the Eurocentric view. We don't just get the Afrocentric view. We get all of those views, and we even spur out into other areas as well, right? Because we understand, as HBCU students, we share the planet with other people. We share the nation with other people. So it ought to be our responsibility to learn what they're learning, right? It take in their curriculum just as much as any other thing that we would do in any other school here in the United States. And I think one of the most beautiful things about HBCUs, because students are represented not just from every state in the union, but from many of the different countries all across the globe, from every single continent, I can say that confidently, is that the one of the largest teachers, or the best teachers rather, on HBCU campuses are the students. Right. And so, you know, in addition to the traditional curriculum that's established by these universities and by these colleges, we have a great supplement coming from students themselves who are able to add on to that and give us a very holistic, diverse picture of what the world is and what it should be.
That's wow. The way you put all of that was absolutely amazing. And like, you know, you were talking about how, like, about the myths of HBCUs only really having quote-unquote Black curriculums. And it's like, people will point out, especially white people will point that out. and not say anything about predominantly white institutions, PWIs, having Eurocentric curriculum. No one's going to make that, no one's really going to make that argument that much.
Absolutely, because, you know, just like you said, it's about, you know, this view that, I forget the word that we use, but let's just call it a sense of white normativity, right? In that, you know, because European and Eurocentric ideas are seen as a baseline, right? And a lot of different facets of society, no one really questions that. It's only questioned when we divert from that. You know, why are we diverting from that? Why aren't we not sticking to this white normativity? And I think, you know, HBCU shine a very bright light on that.
Exactly. Let's now go into really just the nuances of space and the concept of spaces and multicultural spaces. Jacqueline, could you go into that a little bit and with your work with For a Black Girl?
Yes, and just to go back to like what you guys were talking about, I think Nigel kind of was headed into that, and I think that's important, especially in multicultural spaces. It's never like a this or that or a competition. It's like we all understand that we don't like our group doesn't revolve around us, and it's a mutual thing. And so when it comes to multicultural spaces, and my group specifically, I started my club earlier last fall, and it was just a need that I saw and that I was looking for on my campus. I didn't feel like I had a group that I could really connect with, particularly after coming back from COVID and the whole pandemic. I already felt isolated, but even after that, and then in the midst of all the social political issues going on, I really didn't feel like I was being heard or had an outlet that I could go and just kind of be in a place where I was understood. And so I've created that space, and we have discussions on anything from hair and texturism to relationships. And it's just been a really good experience to have girls that I can go to and feel like they also needed what I needed. And so it's just been really rewarding to have that space in the midst of the school that we go to.
Exactly. Like there's this really deep aspect about like the sacredness of multicultural spaces, where there's spaces where people of different racial backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, different gender, sexual orientation, they can go into these spaces even within a lot of these environments that are like PWIs and stuff, that they can go into these spaces, and it's like one of the one places that they can go to where they can feel like they can exist fully as themselves.
Right. And I remember even in the process of trying to get everything started, I had individuals like white males that I had shared my idea with, and they were like, well, why do you need that kind of space? And they didn't understand like why a black student needed their own space in a white school. And it was just really baffling. I guess I shouldn't say that word, but it was a learning experience for me to see like they didn't have the capacity to like recognize that we may not be comfortable where we're going to school, or just even the fact that we can have our own space.
Right. And the reason why a lot of white people are unable to conceptually be able to get why these spaces are needed, it's because they're always going to be in spaces where whiteness is going to be centered. They're always within PWIs, especially where they already have the spaces, and then they're like, well, why does anyone else need a space? Because they are unable to see or outside of themselves.
Right. Even administration has come up and like, well, can other people join? And it's like, it really isn't the same when you, it's just going to be another club if everyone can join. And it just takes away from the true meaning behind having a space for us.
Exactly. Nigel, there was this one Facebook post that you made a couple of years ago about about when you would go to the Bahamas and about how you would experience life there. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The Bahamas, and I'd say the Caribbean as a larger region, is one of these, you know, black spaces, right, that has its share. I don't want to call it infiltration, right, but it has its share of whiteness that comes into it, that kind of, you know, changes the dynamic of how everything is. That post that you're referring to, that was, I believe, on Independence Day, the Bahamian Independence Day of 2020. And what I wrote about was the fact that since the year 2010, I believe, my mother had brought me over to the Bahamas to visit with our family for the summers, right? And she wanted me to be able to see what it's like to, you know, walk down the street without the fear of being harassed by a police officer because of the color of my skin, to experience what it's like to be able to enjoy, you know, the beach or a picnic in a park without someone coming up to me and asking if I have a right to be in this space, right? To be in a place where I can see other Black men and Black women and Black people who look like me, right, who talk like me, who sound like me, thriving, you know, leading in government, leading in the law, leading in the banking and the financial industries, right? And so, you know, the Caribbean has definitely served as a place for, you know, a lot of Black people to find that comfort, right, and find that space. A free Black space where they can express themselves freely. And, you know, I think in certain moments, right, there have been, you know, some issues between Caribbean Americans and African Americans, because they're not the same, who, you know, weren't necessarily exposed to the same type of environment growing up. You know, Caribbean Americans were exposed to this type of environment where they were a little bit more free to say, do, and act how they wanted. And African Americans, you know, while, you know, we live in this nation that we call the land of the home, what is it? Land of the free and the home of the brave. You know, it doesn't always feel that way, right? And it always feels like, you know, we're being watched and we're always being oppressed, and there's some sort of something that's there to keep African Americans down. So, you know, I think people should definitely, especially African Americans, I think they should definitely at least once in their lives experience that type of freedom and environment that exists in the Caribbean. But on the other side of that, I think Caribbean Americans should also put themselves in the shoes of African Americans and see that life is not the same. You know, opportunities are not the same. Just because we have the same skin color doesn't mean we have the same history per se and the same upbringing. So, you know, there are cultural nuances to that, but I think the Caribbean is a very, you know, great example of a Black space where people are able to thrive and express themselves and truly live out the lives that they ought to live without race being a consideration.
Amazing. I want to go back to Jacqueline's earlier point about, like, administration trying to open up the space more. It's just such an incorrect view, because it's up to the people create. When people create a space, it's up to the people creating that space to decide who they want to let in to that space, whose experiences that they want to really center around. And are there going to be bad iterations of that? Absolutely. We saw that in history. But with space creation, especially when it's minoritized groups doing it, it's an incredibly sacred process that should not have interference. Now, does it get interference? Absolutely. It gets interference all the time.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we should talk about just for a second, right? The fact that you're right. It is up to people in those spaces to decide when we want to share those spaces, right? But we also have to talk about the fact that in some cases, right, you have people who are outside of those spaces who, whether they do it, you know, explicitly or inherently, they pretty much deny the existence of a space, right? To your point, they'll ask questions. Why do you even need this? Why do you need your own organization? Why do you need your own club? Why can't we be a part of this? You guys are doing too much. You know, you shouldn't have to be able to have this for yourself. You know, and spaces exist outside of, you know, the I guess things that we can actually touch, physical, right? Let's take something like Juneteenth, for example. Right. You know, there are people who ask, why does Juneteenth have to be celebrated as a national holiday or celebrated as a holiday at all? Right. There are people who ask, why does Black History Month have to be celebrated? Why isn't there a White History Month? Right. There are people who will refuse both to accept the need for a space and to accept that a space even exists. And to your point, Joseph, that's where we've seen things go downhill in history. Right. Going back to, you know, this the Eurocentric theorists that we learn about at Howard, one of them, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, his, you know, predominant theory that everybody knows about him is the social contract theory. Right. That, you know, people exist in wilderness or people exist outside of society, and that when they want to live in society, they band together and they form, you know, groups and, you know, to protect themselves and things like that. But when you have come to the conclusion, right, that a society does not exist, right, that there is no society, that there is wilderness, you have the ability to do whatever you want to, right? That's what leads to colonialism. That's what leads Europeans to be able to come down to West Africa and say, you know what, I don't see any society. I see people, I see language, I see buildings, I see architecture, I see education happening, but I'm not going to acknowledge that society, I'm not going to acknowledge that a Black space even exists. So I'm going to impose my own self, I'm going to impose my own space, you know, and do what I want. And so, you know, it can be something as large as colonialism and slavery, or it could be something as, you know, I don't want to say small, but less consequential, let's call it, as, you know, organizations or students asking why an organization needs its own space on campus or the need for that organization. So I think it's about addressing that mindset in itself, right? Why do these groups feel that they have the right to deny the existence of a space? And when we get to that, I think that's when we can, you know, start moving forward in, you know, building more spaces for more people to be able to live how they want to live and, you know, organize and associate with who they want to associate with.
I definitely agree. I don't know if we'll be able to answer the why. I'm trying to think of that answer myself, but like you mentioned, like this goes back to even colonial times and just the idea of going to places where there are already existing peoples and seeing it as your own. That's when it really started. But I think, like you mentioned, it's a mindset thing. And so, unfortunately, it will be on them to have to come to terms with whatever motive, whatever way of thinking that they have, and kind of changing it to be more understanding, but also doing our part where we can, and with people who are receptive to it, educating them as well.
Wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, and I really liked how y'all really described colonialism as like the one of the ultimate manifestations of white supremacist entitlement, where, as you said, like people or white people back in when colonialism was really being used a lot in its most brutal forms, it was pretty much white people going to different places around the world and ignoring literally everything about the societies that were already present there, literally everything about the cultures that were there, and being like, there is nothing here. We are now entitled to this land. Prepare for war.
That's the formula. Deny and conquer.
And then it says something to me, like, you see this as, like, what was already existent is not good enough for you. And it's like, it could be perfectly fine for, like, people were okay how things were, but it wasn't okay for you. So now it's, you have to come and change it or impose yourself onto it.
Exactly. Like, I was just recently in a study abroad in Germany, and this was for the School of Music. So one of the things that we went to in Leipzig was the archives, or the Bach archives, filled with a bunch of, like, it has a museum in there, and all these a lot of scores of J.S. Bach and his family members. And the person leading the tour of that museum, she was probably one of the most, according to my friend, one of the most socially aware white women, because there was this one thing that she said in, like, a conversation with my friend, where it was, quote, or not quote, but I'm paraphrasing a lot here, but she was like, you know, I always get aggravated at Americans who come over here and say that there's no culture in America. There was culture. You just completely suppressed it in every single way, shape, and form. And my friend was just over here completely flabbergasted that this woman all the way in Germany was able to get this concept way more than pretty much 80% of really America in a lot of ways.
I can also relate to that. I studied abroad in Spain, and I also received, like, similar comments, especially in regard to police brutality. And they were so shocked, like, the idea of, like, me just being out and about in Spain. Like, I was like, I can't do this back home. And they like, empathized with what I was saying, but also was just like, how could it be so dangerous over there? And it was just crazy to see, like you were saying, how people across the world can blatantly see, like, the issues going on, and it's not the same way with how it is here with people.
Yeah, and it's like, in a lot of ways, even, like, with a lot of Western Europe being still highly very much into Eurocentrism and this idea of Western civilization being the ideal, even with that, they're still way more aware of everything than us in a lot of instances. Like, with your experience, Jacqueline, and with that one woman said in Germany, it's like, we just have a somewhat unique problem within our educational system that it's so, in a lot of ways, Eurocentrized. I made up that word, but it's so Eurocentric that it's supremely narrow in ways that, like, even a lot of Western Europe isn't.
I think you summed it up pretty well, Joseph.
All right, so, yeah, no, I think that's actually, like, a really good place to end the episode. Jacqueline and Nigel, thank you so much for coming on to the show and for sharing y'all's experiences. It was absolutely amazing.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, see you next time. All right, that's our show. Thank you so much to Jacqueline and Nigel for coming on to the show. Our intro and outro song is by Olivia Russo Hood. See y'all later.